Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Welcome to Quintessential Listening Poetry. Tonight, I'm here with Kat Gogan, Matt Reifenberg, and Joshua Michael Collins to discuss the play Unstoppable by Design. The play highlights the life of Mr. Reifenberg, who endures throughout a journey of life's obstacles in pursuit to achieve success despite the possibility of failure. Matt, your story is very powerful, and I'd like to thank you for being here tonight and your willingness to have your story brought to the stage.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And us.
Oh, you're more than welcome. All right. And Kat and Joshua, I'd like to thank you as well for bringing Matt's story to life and for the creating such a powerful theatrical experience.
Oh, thank you for having us to share it with everyone.
It was a pleasure of mine, and thank you for having me as well.
You're breaking up. I can't hear you again. Hello? Yeah, you're
we're breaking up again.
Yeah, a few technical difficulties, but we're all still here.
Nope, you're broken up. Can't hear you.
I'm wondering if it's weather induced. There was a thunderstorm here earlier.
Yeah, that could be. It's a little bit better, but you're still broken up.
Okay, now I can hear you perfectly now.
Okay, yeah. Now I can hear you.
Yeah, it must be due to the weather.
Yeah. Okay, what was your question?
Let's continue as much as we can. Let's just continue as much as we can, and if we find that we can't go any further, then we'll reschedule for another evening.
Okay, that's fine.
All right, that's perfect. So, again, the question that I asked is, how did you feel about having your life portrayed on stage?
It was pretty interesting. Having all these personal things put out there is a little disconcerting, but I figured if my story would help other people overcome some of the things that they might be going through and give them some hope and help them to become unstuck, I figured it was worth the whatever embarrassment or, trepidation I might feel.
All right. Well, would you mind sharing a little bit about your story?
So I, where do I begin?
Where do you begin?
So I quit school when I was 15. I just had no interest in going to school and, doing homework and the whole academic thing was just not for me. So I decided to leave. It wasn't a very popular opinion with my mother, as you can imagine. So I did that and kind of bounced around doing different things, painted houses, worked in a gas station, worked in an apartment complex and that sort of thing until I was about, I'd say in my 20s. And then I ended up getting married to someone who ended up being having some addiction issues. And that was not a fun time in my life. And then we had a son together, and after 10 years, we divorced, and I ended up moving to Pennsylvania to because I had met another woman after we were divorced for about 2 years. And then I moved with her, got a job at a small biotech company, worked there for 8 years, and about I ended up getting laid off, and the same week I got laid off, I found out I had a brain tumor. Took about 8 months to get that taken care of. It was removed, and I recovered from that. Started working for another biotech company, and at some point I had gotten a message about a job at Cornell University, and I applied there as a joke, never thinking they'd call me because I know zero about particle physics, which is what they wanted. So, which is what they wanted someone for. So I ended up getting the job, and it was pretty interesting because I, you know, again, I hated school, and here I am working for an Ivy League university designing particle accelerators. So I did that for 5 years, and a magazine did an article about me, and a large engineering company read, somebody at the company read the article, and they contacted me about working on a large nuclear project, which I did for a couple of years. And now I work in Kentucky at the Bluegrass Army Depot, and I am designing, helping to design a process to destroy the rest of the chemical weapons that the U.S. has in inventory.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. So, that is quite a story. You know, William Shakespeare made the statement, well, he wrote the following words, rather, that all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man at his time plays many parts. And that's from As You Like It. You've had a life. You've lived a life.
Yeah, I think so. Hopefully it's not not over, and I don't think it is. I mean, my feeling is, you know, nothing is over until I say it is.
All right. I like that. Well, let me ask this question. What new information did you learn about yourself from this production, from being a part of this experience? What new did you learn?
I learned that I had a story to tell, and that, you know, Kat, at first I was a little reluctant to, do the project. And Kat kind of pointed out to me that, there is some merit in what I've done, and, people will get something from the story. So, I've come to terms with that, and I feel like, you know, it can be a way to create some dialogue for people, and maybe help them in some way, and that's really what I'm interested in doing with it.
And where do you go from here with your journey? What's next on your list?
Kat and I have decided that we're going to write a book. It'll be similar to the play, a lot of different stories and lessons that I learned, and things that I can put in there to help people with, and hopefully it'll be a success. So,
all right.
As far as me personally, who knows? Maybe NASA, maybe SpaceX, something like that would be cool.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Kat, questions for you. All right. Are you ready? You made this statement on Mark Anthony Rossi's podcast, Strength to Be Human, that I want to write plays that engage the audience in thinking and questioning. And then with those results, I want to go a step further and have my plays be a catalyst for action, even if that is just beginning a discussion about a difficult subject to talk about. Tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, I know a lot of, you know, some plays or movies or whatever you might write or for entertainment, you know, just to make you laugh or, I mean, there's all kinds of purposes. But for me, things that I'm drawn to for writing subjects, they are usually things that address social awareness kinds of issues and things that I think have the potential at least to start a dialogue or to make someone think or reexamine and then to take some type of action, whether that's personal action or on a larger scale. So that's really the writing that appeals to me most. And, you know, I mean, obviously, I from time to time do silly kinds of writing, as I call it, that really to me doesn't have much of a purpose except for to make someone laugh for a moment or whatever. But my serious writing or what I would want to be remembered for writing are generally a little mixture of comedy, but mostly drama and always with some type of issue. And I try to, you know, choose an issue and stay neutral. Like, I don't want to be the person who says, this is the way you need to think about this issue. I just want to examine the issue and then let people, you know, speak to them however it will, as far as the action that they need to take.
What's the first hook that gets a new play started for you? Is it an image, a theme, or a character?
For this particular play or just in general?
Just in general right now.
You know, sometimes it's been something as simple as a typo. That there's always a trigger, and I won't say it's always, it's seldom a picture. It's mostly a trigger that comes about, whether it's someone says something or something comes out the wrong way, or someone's just saying, like, what if, you know, this happened, and then it just triggers something in my mind. That's the way it works for me. So there's a trigger, and it's usually a verbal kind of trigger, whether I see it, you know, written or spoken. It's usually words.
Okay.
No, I'm not,
you know,
really
as we
visual like that.
All right. Well, as we think about Unstoppable by Design, what were the circumstances which led to your reading the CORE article? And for those who don't know, CORE is a place to gain and share knowledge. It is a platform to ask questions and connect with people who contribute unique sites, insights, and quality answers.
Well, I guess it's my own story, as you were saying, you know, all the world's a stage.
Yes.
In September of 2017, my father, who I was very close to, was having abdominal pain, and so I took him to the ER. He walked in, and, you know, everything seemed to be that, you know, possibly he had an infection or a little dehydration. We thought maybe some kind of stomach virus or something, but they admitted him for observation. And it appeared with the antibiotics, and they had given him some fluids, that, you know, he was doing better by the next morning when I called to see, you know, how he had been for the night. And so we arrived, my mother and I arrived at the hospital that morning. And when we got there, there were people standing outside of his room, and they looked to be hospital workers. They told my mother that my dad had passed away just before we arrived. So you know, from thinking it was a stomach virus to calling that morning and them saying he was doing well to arriving and hearing the most awful news I could imagine, you know, that he had passed away and that we weren't there and we didn't get to say goodbye or we didn't get to say anything. I was pretty hysterical. And, you know, this had always, my dad had always, I guess maybe with all children, maybe there's one parent that you're more like or more, you know, for whatever reason you click with. And it, for me, it was my dad always. So I didn't know what I would do. I thought I would die. I just really didn't think I could handle that news. And, you know, so we stayed in the hallway, not knowing what to do. They were supposed to be looking for a room for us to go to try to calm down, but that never was found. And so about 30 minutes later, I see what appears to be my father being wheeled down the hallway in a wheelchair. And I'm thinking, am I seeing, you know, am I hallucinating? Am I dead? I mean, are we both dead? I mean, I just could not process seeing him because I had thought he was dead for 30 minutes. But as it turned out, there had been a mix-up of patients, and someone else was dead, and it wasn't my father.
Wow.
So it was, you know, that was a trauma then of its own, of trying to readjust to the fact that he was alive. And, you know, of course, people will always ask, like, you know, why wouldn't that just be, like, all happy? But, you know, it doesn't work like that with emotions. Like, I couldn't just turn the switch on and off from the most terrible thing that ever I could imagine. You know, of course, part of me was so glad, and I expressed that with my dad by hugging him. And, you know, he was like, what's wrong with you? Because I was crying, and he had never seen me that way, and I had never been that way. Because there was nothing that ever could have affected me to make me that way until I heard the news of my dad dying. But, you know, we spent the rest of the day together, and I went home that night. It was really hard to process it all and to try to, you know, find some sleep so we could go back the next day. But, a little after 5 that morning, the phone rang, and I could see it was the hospital's number. So, obviously, I knew calling at that time, it probably was not going to be good news. So, you know, the nurse said that my dad, that his heart rate had slowed, and they needed us to come to the hospital. But, you know, long story short, before I even got out of the door to go to the hospital, they called back and said my father had passed away, and this time it was for real. So, you know, there's really just like a 12-hour span of my dad being, you know, alive and then dead and then alive and dead. It was more than I could deal with, I think. And so from that would have been September to 22nd of 2017. And for a year, I was just pretty much in some kind of a depression and a daze. Like I was in life, but I wasn't, I was just existing. I wasn't a participant anymore in life. So that's what brought me to Quora that night, just basically doing mindless kinds of scrolling, which is basically all I had done. It was like I really thought life was over. I didn't think I would live. And since I didn't physically live, I didn't think mentally you know, that there was any life, anything left for me after that happened with my dad. So that's what brought me there. And, you know, there was, people have different opinions and thoughts on if things happen for a purpose or,
yes,
you know, if it's just all random. I believe I was meant to be at Quora and read the article and all the things that would follow. I feel they were designed to happen for me. But
so, what was it about Matt's story in particular that stood out?
Well, it was, he was replying to a young person who was asking if their life was over because they weren't as far along in their career, not making as much money. You know, they listed some things and they were in their 20s and just questioning if life was over. And, you know, I'm thinking, no, your life's not over. My life's over. You know, I've lost my dad 2 times here. And, you know, I'm the one that's like life is over for. So, I wasn't really that sympathetic to the question being posed by the young person, which is odd for me because in general, you know, I spent my life teaching. I love young people, but I just wasn't in that frame of mind. I wasn't capable of that right at the time. And so Matt had responded and outlined much of like what he outlined for you, only in a shortened version. There were just a few of the things that he had included. And so one of the things that stood out to me was that he got the job at Cornell, but he was a high school dropout. So being a high school teacher, that, you know, that fascinated me because a lot of students I had over the years that dropped out, they really didn't find similar successes. So, you know, that piqued my curiosity. And then, you know, as I looked at it again, the compassion that Matt had shown in his answer, and that he had taken the time to reach out to this person in a kind way when, you know, I was more angry as a person. The compassion struck me at that time. So, you know, for whatever those triggers that I talk about her stories, I thought, you know, if I could find out what led him to be successful, you know, I think there's a story in that. Mm-hmm. So that's the trigger, and that's what led me to Quora.
All right. What was that, Matt? What was that phone call like, the very first one that you received from Kat?
Well, we talked by email first, and then we went to texting, and you know, she asked a lot of questions, and probably 2 weeks later, she had told me that she needed to write a play for, I don't remember, it was a, she had to submit a play for something she was doing, and had decided she wanted to write something about me. And at first I was like, okay. And then after she sent me a list of questions, which I wrote answers to and sent it to her. And she wrote the first draft of the play from that. And then, 80,000 more texts and phone conversations. And we had hammered out the first version of the play. It's changed a little bit since then. We tried to change it to be more real, and I guess it's all real, but more true to life for me. She had me doing some things in the play that I wouldn't normally do, like crying, and I said, no, that's got to go. So,
no crying for you. All right.
Yeah, she'd have me wearing a bow tie if she could get me to do it, but no.
I'm not giving up, Mike.
So, Kat. Well, I was going to ask this question. Kat, as you thought about what you'd read, what made you think that would work for the stage?
Well, you know, at that moment, I really didn't think that far ahead. I just thought it's the first time that I've had any kind of thoughts of writing or of doing anything. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it wasn't a well thought out plan, that's for sure. And then when I started writing these questions and started finding out, you know, like it's way more than just getting a job at Cornell and you dropped out of high school. I mean, there's the brain tumor, there's addiction, there's like all these other things that I'm thinking, you know, I've got this person excited. They've shared all this with me. And what if I can't do it? You know, what if it's not going to play out on the stage? So that did cross my mind. But, you know, things don't I don't give up easily. Let's just say that. So, you know, what appears to be like an obstacle, you could tell me no 500 times, then I'm going to ask 501 or whatever. I'm
All
not
right.
easy to throw in the towel. So, you know, once I just kept thinking, you know, I am going to write this story. I don't know how, but I'm going to. And once I decided how it was going to be structured is that we're going to structure this, you know, starting with the Cornell interview, and then all of the questions and so forth are going to trigger flashbacks. And that's how I'm going to fit these events of his life in. So once that came to me, you know, the structure, it pretty much wrote itself after that point because he had given me all the information. I knew mm-hmm. what I wanted to do at that point. So,
the structure is primarily told in flashbacks.
Yes, it takes place, you know, within the confines of the interview. But, you know, as they ask him questions about previous work experiences or challenging personal experiences, you know, as he's starting to give the answer, then the answer will flash back to these particular things in his life.
Now, we're talking how many months from the time that you and Matt started talking until the first performance? How long did it take?
The first performance was May 10th as far as it's when Linkamp High School. I like to give
yes.
a shout out to them because they're great. And Mason, she is a student from that school and was in the cast. So I want to definitely say how proud I am that they're the school that premiered the play. But
yes.
we wrote the play. I mean, the play was ready to, it could have been performed, but probably within what, Matt, 2 months?
Yeah, probably. We did have a reading on St. Patrick's Day, which was ironically the same day as the surgery that I had for the tumor. And it was also
wow.
my mother's birthday, which was kind of interesting.
What are the chances of that? We had no input into the date of the reading. It just got assigned. And then, you know, there's just so many things that happened in this. I mean, nobody would even believe it. But I know you will. And all the listeners will after they hear it. But truth is stranger than fiction.
Well, question for you, too. What did you learn about yourself from writing Unstoppable by Design?
Kat?
Yes, we sort of have this thing where I'm going first, so I should have known that. I mean, in the writing of it, I feel like that I was writing a message that was meant for me. You know, I needed to become unstuck. And even though it was Matt's life that was, you know, detailing how it happened for him. I was the one telling that story, but the message I was telling, I feel like, was for me. I needed to get unstuck from this grief and depression and hopelessness of losing my father, and I needed to move forward again, and that was the message that I got from writing it.
All right. You know, being a noted playwright, what advice would you give someone who's just starting?
You know, I think you really have to like with anything, you have to feel like that's what you want to devote a lot of your time to, and that it's not going to be just the fun stuff, you know, like formatting the play and sending it to publishers and doing all the things that are not fun. That's going to be a bigger part of it than thinking of the plots and, you know, seeing everybody in the audience stand up and get a standing ovation. I think my first thing would be to make sure that you're really committed to doing the dirty work, I guess, or the things that nobody tells you about, the non-glamorous parts. And there's a great quote in the play, which I'll let Matt tell about that later, because it really applies more to him in many ways. But it is true. So I would think that's the first thing, is making sure that you're committed to doing it. And then, you know, after that, I think researching the markets is very important, because you can have a great play, but if publishing company, if it doesn't fit the demographics that they're marketing to, they're not going to accept it. So you really need to do your research and make sure that when you submit the plays, that you have a good idea that it's going to fit into that market. Because, you know, you could write a great play, and if no one ever performs it, it's going to be on your computer, and that's not really going to benefit anyone. So it's more than just the writing, and you have to be committed to doing all of the work.
What were some of the... Okay, please continue.
Accepting a rejection.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
I'm going to say no.
What were some of the major obstacles that needed to be overcome in terms of producing this particular play?
I think a large cast is one obstacle. A male-dominated cast is another obstacle, especially if you're like gearing towards the high school market. You know, there are more females in drama programs generally, and also they're not necessarily looking for a large cast. And then you've got the flashbacks. So, you know, you're going to have to either use lighting, or you're going to have to figure out ways that, you know, how are you going to have these actors on stage during the, how are you going to change the scene so quickly? So I think, you know, those would be the biggest obstacles that if I was the one directing the play. I think those are obstacles.
What are you working on now?
Okay. Hold back.
Okay. What are you working on right now?
Oh, we started the book. We've outlined it. I've actually started writing the first chapter, and you know, I think it's going along well, and I think it will be an equally good product once we're finished, although the time frame will be a bit longer than the play, I think.
All right. Well, where can readers learn more about you and your work? Where can we find you?
I have a website. Yeah, I have a website, so you can go to www.mayihaveyourattentionplease.com, and you can see video performances of different plays and, you know, upcoming performances, biography, those kinds of things.
Right, because that's where I found you.
Oh, well.
Yes. So, again, I did my research.
Matt also, you know, when I first had contact with him, and I'm sure he first thought maybe, like, you know, are you sure you're a playwright or whatever. But, you know, he actually had done some research, too. So.
Oh, really?
I was like, this could be like some just, you know, crazy woman who said, yeah, I want to write a play about you. And I was like,
That's true.
So she was legit.
It was my pickup line, you know.
So we both checked you out. So.
And I am legitimate,
Joshua,
America.
You are legitimate. That's correct. Joshua, it's time to bring you into the mix. What inspired you to take up acting?
Well, when I was a child, I played baby Jesus at church in a play, and I've been acting ever since.
Well, that's a great way to start.
But my first spoken lines were in fifth grade, and I knew instantly that that was for me. And once I got into high school, the only drama program around was Kathy's class, and I just felt at home. And when I'm acting, that's really the most alive that I feel.
All right. Well, how did you prepare for the role of playing Matt Reifenberg? How did you prepare?
Well, for Matt, I felt an instant empathy. For one, I've had similar type situations. I once dated a girl who had a substance abuse problem, and I understand how frustrating and how much damage that can do to a person's mind to love someone that loves something else just as much, if not more, than you. I'm not saying that's what happened in his case, but anyway. And towards the end, and towards the end of the outtake that you'll hear from me, you know, as an artist, we all have a certain goal, and you know, when you achieve that goal, that's just how I imagined I would react in that situation.
What was it like that very first evening when Matt was in the audience and you were portraying him? What did you feel?
Well, I felt like I was, well, actually, and one thing that I did leave out is I did actually meet him before I got to perform him. And
all right.
And so that helped out a lot. So
all right. Well, one last question before we move into the reading itself. What did you learn about yourself from acting, playing Matt in Unstoppable by Design?
What I learned about myself is...
Yes.
Is that it's okay for me to take a path that's not the norm to get to where I want to be in life. And like myself... As an actor, I'm a little bit older, and I'm not moving out to Hollywood to take the normal route like I probably should. But if I can make it here, you know, why can't I make it anywhere else? And that's just it. It's more of an inspiration to me that knowing that I can take a different route to my goals.
Very nicely stated. Very nicely stated. I think it's time for a reading.
All right.
Great.
All right, Kat, you want to set this scene up?
Want to set it up?
Kat, go ahead.
And Mason Mitchell.
Yes, hello.
Hello. How are you tonight?
Good. How are you?
Great. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
I look forward to hearing you read.
Thank you.
All right. So, Kat, would you like to set it up for us?
I think, actually, Josh is prepared to set up this thing. So we'll turn it over to Josh.
All right. So here's a reading from Joshua Michael Collins and Mason Mitchell, a reading from Unstoppable by Design.
In this thing, it starts out at the interview, and then I'll read some of the screen directions, and you'll know where we're going. Most of the time in my work experience, I have worked pretty much independently and haven't really encountered a difficult person that stands out. My personal life has had a few. one thing that really has a lot to do with how I got here today took place when I was married to my first wife. Scene flashes back and lights come up on a living room. Matt is pacing the floor. Kelly is staggering in. Kelly!
That's me.
I'm pretty sure I know your name by now. What I don't know is where you've been.
I've been out. Yeah, that's it. Out.
I know you've been out.
You always were the observant one. Did you pick up any beer?
Kelly goes to the fridge and starts tossing food items out. Matt goes over to the fridge and tries to pick up the items she tosses. Kelly tosses a ketchup bottle, which hits Matt in the head. Kelly, stop, damn it. That hurt.
Oh, lighten up. It's a plastic bottle. Are you a pansy?
You're going to wake up Justin. Will you please keep it down?
Kelly, will you do this? Kelly, will you do that? What even? Not one freaking beer in this whole house. You're useless.
I'm useless?
Did I stutter?
You sure as hell did stutter. And you're staggering all over the place, too. It's 2 a.m. and you're just getting home. I think I deserve to know where you've been.
No beer. No answers.
Kel, I'm working 2 jobs, and we have a 2-year-old that needs a mother and a father. He barely knows who you are because you sleep all day and stay out all night. We're not teenagers anymore.
Now that you mention it, you are starting to look a lot older. I'm as hot as I ever was.
And as drunk.
You didn't seem to mind it when I was drunk. And we...
Stop it. Kel, you've got to grow up. Justin needs us. He needs you. And so do I. I love you, Kel. I don't want to fight with you.
You love me? I don't even see how you can say that the way you treat me.
What?
As soon as I walk through that door every night, there you stand with that accusing tone. Where have you been, Kel? You know what time it is, Kel? You need to grow up, Kel. I'm sick of being treated like a child. You're not my dad, and I'm a grown woman. And I'm going to do whatever I want.
Just calm down and talk about this. I mean, come on. Can't you see if I'm upset?
No, I really can't.
I was worried sick, not knowing where you are or if you're safe. What if something happened? I have no idea how to even reach.
Oh, like what's going to happen? Hello, 911, where's my wife? Seriously, do you worry about these stupidest things? I'm stuck in this house all day. You're not.
That's right, I'm not. I'm out busting my ass with my first job. And if I'm lucky, I can eat a bite of something before my second job. Then I get home, expecting my wife to be glad to see me. But instead, you're out the door, and I'm pacing the floors at 2 a.m. and watching the baby. I'll be lucky to sleep a couple of hours before I get up and start that damn cycle all over again.
Oh, boo-hoo. Sometimes I don't know who the baby is. You or Justin.
Stop.
You always play the victim. No one asked you to work 2 jobs.
No one asked me? Who do you think pays the bills, pays the rent, buys food? I'd love if I could just work a normal job and come home and be with you and Justin, but we're barely scraping by now.
At least I graduated from high school.
Well, by all means, take that high school diploma and start helping support this family.
I could do a better job of it than you, that's for freaking sure. And we have beer.
What's stopping you? Since we've been married, you've had zero jobs. I have two, and sometimes a part-time third job just to stay afloat. All the money I do make, you just drink it away. If you can do so much better, why aren't you?
Matt, you're a high school dropout. You're a maintenance man at a tennis club and work at a laundromat. You know who that's better than? Nobody. Remember when I met you in the bar and you said you liked me and I said that you might as well marry me?
Yes, of course I remember.
Biggest mistake of my life.
Stop! That was really nice of you to say.
You weren't anything when I met you, and you aren't anything now. You'll never be anything more than you are right now. And that's nothing. Get used to it. This is your life, and because I was so freaking stupid, it's my life too.
Really? That's pretty funny coming from you. Matt sits down, saying not another word, just staring ahead into space. The lights dim and come up on the interview. That's the end of that scene, right?
All right.
Yes, good job, guys.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And that was great.
Thank you.
Are we ready to go to the second scene?
Yes.
Okay. And this one is the last monologue of the play. It is after Matt got the job at Cornell. And, let me just make sure that I don't have any noises interrupting. So if you don't mind... Maybe about 30 seconds or less. I do apologize.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah, Sarah, while you're doing that, Josh, this is the very last words, the last monologue of the play. And I really feel like it sums up the entire play or the message of the play and that it's the last thing people will hear and hopefully the thing that stays in the forefront of their mind as they leave from the play.
Sorry about that horn, guys. Okay, I'm back.
All right.
Okay.
Are you ready for me now?
Yes.
Cool. All right. I look at it like this. I can't change the past. I can't predict the future, and for sure, I can't make anyone do anything they're unwilling to change on their own. Today is what I can change for me. Today, I can stop doing X and start doing Y. Today, I can execute at the highest level I'm able to. Today, I can live like there's no tomorrow, because when you get right down to it, there isn't. Life is pretty crazy, and these days it feels like I'm on the downhill toboggan, right? Towards death. The hill is steep, the toboggan is on fire and picking up speed. Today, I can hope I design the toboggan I'm on well enough, so I can at least enjoy the ride. Today is all I have. Last fate.
Sweet. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Beautifully, beautifully, beautifully read. Today is all I have. Today is all that I have. That's such a powerful statement.
Yeah, Matt is, he's really insightful. And it made writing the play so much easier because he really put a lot of thought, not just for the play, but I think as he went through life and reflected, I really just am amazed at how insightful I think that he is.
I'm glad you said is and not was. I'm glad she said is and not was.
Is and not was.
Oh, well, if you want me to change it.
She keeps threatening to kill me off at some point because every play she's written has somebody who dies in it.
That's true. He is the only living survivor. So far, dun dun dun.
So far, yeah.
So far. Well. Any further thoughts from you, Kat, for Matt, from Joshua Michael? Any further thoughts before we close out?
I would like Matt to say the line that I wanted to use about the line, because I think that stuck with me, and I would like him to explain it. All right.
So there is a line in the play. It says, "Everybody wants to be a lion until it's time to hunt," which to me means that everybody wants to be successful and, you know, achieve their goals and stuff, but very few people are willing to do the work that it takes in order to do that. Sometimes you have to make really hard choices and, you know, maybe unpopular opinions, or you may have to go against what someone wishes for you or wants you to do or thinks you should do or act in a certain way or whatever. My feeling is, you know, life is short and, you know, happiness is the most important thing, and your personal happiness has to come first. You know, I know people who are struggling with different things. You know, they might be influenced by friends or, you know, even parents or things like that. And, you know, you just have to be willing to make the hard choices, and, you know, it may be unpopular for a while, but in the end, you'll be much better off because of making the choices for you and not to please someone else. So that's where that line, what that line means to me.
I'm just trying to allow it to sink in. That's very powerful.
Thank you. I wish I had come up with it, but I think it was, I heard it, I think the guy's name was Eric Thomas.
Okay.
I read a, or listened to a podcast from him, and that's where it came from. But in the context of my life, it's certainly helped. I generally do things as I see fit and live life my way. You know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword sometimes.
Yes.
You have to be accountable for your actions, and you know, it's been not the easiest road. There are things I could have done to make life easier, maybe staying in school. I don't condone someone quitting school. I think education is a great thing. You know, I've been lucky in a lot of ways, been in the right place at the right time on occasion. And, you know, so maybe I've had, you know, the opportunity to do things that people wouldn't normally do, whether it's by my design or, you know, I've had help along the way because nobody does anything alone. So, you know, it's just, for me, it is what it is. And, you know, I don't think my life is overly special. I think, you know, I'm a pretty ordinary guy for the most part. Some people may say differently.
Yes, it's been interesting. Your story is extraordinary, though. Your story is extraordinary.
Yeah. It's been interesting, some of the comments that we've received on, you know, some of the stuff that we've done. I won't share them. It's just been interesting. Let's say that.
Okay. Interesting in a good way?
Not always.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. There was a drunken asshole comment, but yeah.
But there's always one
we
or
won't
two
get
of those
into
around.
That. Yeah.
Always one or two of those around. But there are none on the line tonight. That's the main thing. So
that's
what's most important. Kat, any concluding words from you?
I just want to say, I think in conclusion that, you know, this was a different type of writing for me, writing, you know, something that wasn't fiction. And I wanted to, I guess I needed to step out of the role of playwright more. I was just sort of a medium of a storyteller, you know, which is really Matt's life really wrote the play, and I just was like the, you know, the vehicle that kind of organized it and put it together. And I also was the brain that saw that, you know, that it really could make a compelling play. You know, later I think Matt, he came to see the value of it, but it is a compelling play, and he is a very unique person. And I think if we had more math, the world would be a much better place.
Wow.
That's my conclusion.
All right. Oh, thank you, Kat.
Yeah, that was very nice. Very nice. Well, we've come to the end of the program, and I'd like to thank all of you, my guests, for being here tonight. The play Unstoppable by Design, the next part of the journey, is a book. I look forward to purchasing the book. I'm sure it'll be somewhere on Amazon.com. So I want to thank you for calling in, and I want you all to have a very great evening.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, have
a good night.
Good evening.
You too.
Right. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.